done by today. There we are, a good piece of nonsensical rhetoric. I was hoping to actually invest a great deal and have a group of people who would sit around in costume and yell, spam, 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 in emulation of something that's too well known to bother going into further detail. But instead of that, I've got a crowd of one up here. Eric Ullman was the author of Deliver Mail, which magically turned into Send Mail. He was the chief programmer of the Ingress Project, leader of the Mammoth Project. He's the author of TSET, of the ME macros, which I proudly use all the time still. And he's going to spam all of us. Have I got that right?
Sure.
Anyway, in all likelihood in this group, I don't need to say much more about Eric, so here's Eric.
So, good morning, everyone. It's nice to see I'm not the only one showing up at the last minute here. And Peter forgot Syslog, which Bill Cheswick says is balances out my karma. I want to talk to you some about essentially what the state of the world is in spam. I do apologize. This morning I woke up and like took two steps back from my laptop and went, oh, I've got like twice as many slides as I need, so, or I have time for. So I'm going to maybe flip through some of these pretty quickly. I want to emphasize, this is my talk. It's not SendMail Inc.'s talk. It's not Yahoo's talk. It's not Microsoft's talk. It's not even a talk representing Bob's Sushi Bar and Bait Shop. It's me and me alone. So if you want to beat somebody up, please don't call my CEO and complain. It's kind of a grab bag. I tried to get it consistent, but there's so much going on. Trying to give you a picture of the overview necessarily involves some jumping around. I started off doing some stuff on legislation, but I decided to take all of that out because who in this room cares anyway? Little data, a lot of math, lots and lots of arm waving, a whole bunch of opinion. The other thing I want to emphasize is you'll see some things come up, so, you know, I'm kind of doing a taxonomy here, and you'll see a couple of things come up multiple times. And that's because a lot of these things, the solutions actually fit in more than one area, so I've replicated them as necessary. So, every anti-spam talk I've ever seen starts out almost exactly the same way. So there's three slides on what is spam anyway. Does anyone need me to explain this? There's two slides saying how that spam is bad. Two slides saying, no, 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 it means it's really, really bad. And it's getting worse, three slides. Did I mention, by the way, how bad it is? If we don't fix spam right now, all of London will be buried under 25 feet of spam by 2014. 2104, sorry. 2014 might be more accurate. Oh, by the way, it's really, 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 really bad. The sky is falling. Buy my product and all of your problems will be solved. 17 slides. So now that I've gotten that out of the way, let me just throw up to give you an idea of what's going on. And by the way, part of this is to give you an idea of how crazy the numbers are here. Some things that I've heard in various places, I've put references where I had them. Unfortunately, one of them, I couldn't find the reference. It's been claimed there are approximately 80, quote-unquote, world-class spammers who pay, mind you, out of their pockets $100,000 a month for their connectivity, because they have a lot of connectivity. Spamhouse claims just a few days ago that 200 spam operations account for 90% of all of the spam that's sent. You know, I'm not sure about this number, because I couldn't find the Linux Pro reference online, but David Harris, in an article that I saw in print, said that spam costs, it was either 300 microcents per message to send. That's just the sending side. And it's the first time I saw a number on this. To give you an idea of how that works, for the price of a cup of coffee, you can send, well, call it 8 million spams or 800 million, depending on which number I've got right. There's substantial evidence that so-called spam king Ralsky, who's supposed to be like among the worst spammers in the world, was able to pay $740,000 in cash to buy a new house. AOL, according to Carl Hutzler, who's the director of anti-spam operations at AOL, and so is probably in a position to know, says that 80% of all incoming mail that AOL receives is rejected as spam. And if any of you know anyone who's on AOL, they complain about how much spam they get. Think about that one a little bit. Mail Anti-Abuse Working Group claimed that in 2003, email volume on the whole, across the board, increased 600% in 1 year. Now that's a growth curve. This is one of the fun ones. Claim from AOL is that zombie machines generate 90% of all spam. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution says at least 40%. Sandvine, as quoted in the Register, said 4/5, 80%. You know, so pick your number. None of these are, 40% is the smallest, and I think that that's optimistic. I said there'd be arm waving. I just thought accidentally I might throw in some data. This is not representative, but this is my personal mailbox. It's the green line down at the bottom is my work mailbox, which has not been around as long. The address has only been around for about 6 years, as opposed to the red line, which is my home mailbox. It's been around approximately since the dawn of time. The interesting thing is to see how it kind of spikes up there earlier this year. And of course, the blue line's the sum. So that, folks, is a real curve based on data, as opposed to my going in and drawing curves freehand, which seems to be what the rest of the world does. Okay, what I really want to talk about is the technology. This is just a summary. I'm going to go into all of these in some more detail. We are seeing quite a bit more technology coming online now, and they're using more methods. Some of them actually seem dubious, I suppose I should say. But some of them actually look really promising. So, and any new ideas are probably a good thing. The granddaddy of all anti-spam technologies, the real-time black hole lists, which I believe started at MAPS, they are controversial in large part because they tend to have a lot of collateral damage. That is to say, the false positive rate is really high because they're really quite broad. They tend to say, well, I think I'll blacklist all of, Comcast. And there are legitimate people on Comcast. I don't know if they can find them, but there are some in there. Content filtering kind of seems to fall into about three classes. This isn't approximately the order in which they were invented or implemented. Heuristics, fingerprinting and collaboration, and machine learning. Challenge response systems have been around for quite some time in various forms. CR is nearly always combined with one of these other schemes, so you see it come up in various places. It is very controversial, too. We're in the period now where we're getting into traffic analysis kind of systems, and there are companies out there doing that are getting fairly interesting results. And the one I'm deeply involved in right now is this question of identity. Sender authentication is opens up a whole new world of, a whole new class of solutions. So I'll talk about that more. And then finally, not yet really explored our economic schemes. So I don't have a lot to say about RBLs. You folks presumably have a pretty good idea of it. you know DNS-based lists. Yeah, the main thing about them, by the way, is that the folks who run them vary from, you know, good, honest people who really try hard to folks that are, you know, evidence that they are vengeful and, for example, put people on their black hole list just because they don't like them, but not that they send spam. So, you know, if you are going to use RBLs, choose carefully. Increasingly, because of the problems of false positives, they're not being used to block connections, but they're used as input into some other algorithm, and that seems like a quite reasonable way to go about it. Heuristic filters. This can be summarized as sort of expert systems. Smart people look at spam, they go, oh, the spammers are doing this, I can detect that and reject the message. Classic example was, for a while, a lot of spam was coming out claiming to have gone through a Microsoft Exchange or Outlook or whatever. There's a header in there that identified it as coming from that, except the header was one that could not possibly be generated by the software it was claiming to be. So if you see that, you know that it must be spam. Other things you might look for are HTML weirdness, encoding tricks. If you see white on white in the HTML, that may be an indication that there's something funny about this message. Lots of dollar signs or exclamation points, so forth. All of these, however, leave the good guys, and that is us, I hope. Any spammers in the room? Because if you are, I have to cut short some of these slides. Leaves us in a reactive mode. That is to say, they get to send the spam, and then we get to react to that, and after some amount of time, we'll put our stuff in place. In the meantime, in that gap, they're spamming. The problem is heuristic features, some time back, actually started decreasing in effectiveness. We send out our tools, and I can't believe anyone here is naive enough to believe that these spammers don't look at them and going, oh, they're detecting this, I will do something else. Generally speaking, heuristics is an arms race. It gets more and more expensive, and it's unwinnable. Heuristics are kind of useful on a gross level, but that's just not where the future is. Fingerprinting and collaboration, it's been around, as I said, for some time, but becoming a little bit more popular now. It's a central clearinghouse of known spam. The idea is you take a fingerprint of some sort so you don't have to store the whole message, and you distribute those to other people, and they can take a fingerprint of an incoming message, compare them, and if they're the same, you've got a very, very high probability that that message actually is spam, and you can discard it. It's got an extremely low false positive rate. That's the real good thing about it. Because it tends to actually look at the entire message, although the algorithms, hashing algorithms, are generally so-called fuzzy hashing, in particular snowflaking, the use of random words in messages is a tactic to get around this. So if you throw in some random words, then the fingerprints of two otherwise identical spams won't be the same. There was a claim that I heard from a company, but I'm not going to name them because I haven't been able to validate that this is true, that if you update the database every 5 minutes, it's kind of okay, but what you really want is to update your database every 15 seconds. Every 15 seconds, you get a set of fingerprints for every spam in the world. Cool. Well, there's another issue, too. The collaborative approaches, of course, work by collaboration, and that means people are going to be sending in these fingerprints and whatnot, and they're not all good players. So you have to come up with some way to work around that. In open source, there's Vipple's Razor is the best known example of these. Commercially, Brightmail does this. CloudMark has something they call SpamNet, which is actually Vipple actually works at CloudMark, so surprisingly enough, it's an adaptation of that open source code. What lots and lots of people are talking about now, Marcus, I knew you'd do it. Come on, Marcus, come up here. No. Machine learning filters. The idea is instead of having smart people look at heuristics, have the computer do the hard work. There's a lot of known machine learning algorithms. I was using neural nets to do speech recognition 12 years ago, something like that. The best known, of course, is naive Bayesian classifiers. That's what everyone uses these days. State vector machines are another one that's in the literature, and I've heard that some people have started to implement these. I have no idea yet what the performance of state vector machines are. Anything based on my knowledge of speech recognition, feature extraction, that is to say, figuring out what to look at in the message can be tricky. The usual one is you just break on words, so each word is a so-called feature, but you could have features that were phrases or a feature that was some other observation about the message. And then you just you get two piles of training data, the good stuff or the bad stuff, and feed them into the algorithm, and the algorithm learns, and life is great. Some of the algorithms actually do work up to n piles, where n is kind of an arbitrary number, although the algorithm tends to explode if you get n too large. The main thing that we've noticed about Bayesian filters, at least, is that although it works pretty well, like in Mozilla or something, where it knows about you, it doesn't work very well at, for example, a corporate firewall. And the more people it has to deal with, the worse it gets. The reason for that is because, notice the two piles of training data, one of which is the good mail. Well, my good mail may look very similar from day to day, but my good mail and the good mail of the guy sitting next to me is probably very different. And so it really trashes the learning algorithm here. And I want to emphasize that getting that training set of not spam is, first of all, very hard to do because people kind of don't want their private mail handed over to somebody to do training, unless, of course, you're like in your browser where it's purely yours. And it has to be representative. So if you self-edit and take out the confidential stuff, you're actually crippling the algorithm. So, well, that's not supposed to be there. Well, I want to go over Bayes' theorem a little bit because everyone talks about it and very few people know what it means. That's Bayes' theorem. The probability that a class of, in this case, a message is C, given the state vector X equaling the one that actually comes in, is the probability that of that class coming up times the probability that the state vector is what it is given the class. Notice that flips the two things there, divided by the probability of the state vector itself. But these two probabilities, probability of X given C and probability of X, are hard to compute, very hard to compute. In fact, if they were easy to compute, we would be done. It basically is trivial. So you make the so-called naive assumption that the individual X's are independent of one another. And this is a great, big, huge assumption. And so you get the algorithms that you see here, which are relatively simple to compute. They just involve a pi over some information that you really already have. And a little bit of sigmas and all that great stuff. And we come up with this extremely elegant equation, which I'm sure is so obvious I don't have to explain it to anyone. You do want it explained, come up afterwards. I was actually going to explain it, but since I have too many slides, I'm afraid it'll have to be later. Challenge response. Challenge response is heavily allow-listed or white-listed, depending on the terminology you're using, based, because the basic idea is if I don't know you, I send you a challenge, and when you successfully answer that challenge, then I put you in my whitelist so that the next time it comes through, you won't have to go through it again. And of course, a recipient can say, even if you successfully answered the challenge, I don't want to hear from you ever again. The challenges themselves can be arbitrarily complex, as simple as reply to this message, or as complicated as, for example, human or computational puzzles. Standard human puzzle that people tend to use these days, this is, by the way, in the literature, sometimes called Turing tests, is to give an image of a word that's been fuzzed out. Human beings can read them, but vision algorithms are not so sophisticated, at least not on cheap hardware. And it just, tell me what this word says. There is, computational has put some CPU cycles or memory bandwidth into some complex algorithm just to prove to me that you have consumed some of your resources. The main point here is to make it impossible for somebody to send you millions of messages on a home PC because there's just not enough cycles there. There is, unfortunately, some evidence that spammers can subvert at least the human puzzles. This is great. Once again, this is unsubstantiated. It's still in the rumor level. But apparently, since more people are using this vision thing, the spammers have gotten together with another class of people. And I can't insult them because I think there's at least one person in that business in this room. The spammers take the challenges that they get and they connect them with porn sites and saying, free porn if you take this word and type it in. And then they use that to feed back. And rumor is that that's, well, you know, there's always a market for pornography, right? Particularly if it's free. Okay, and a kind of interesting area that I've been looking at a little bit more lately is traffic-based filtering. The idea here is you just observe the traffic patterns. I've heard at this conference some mentions of this sort of thing. If grandma, I believe was the phrase, sends a few messages a day, or the quote was a message every 3 days, but so fine, let's say under 100 messages a day, and suddenly starts sending a million messages out in one batch, it's a pretty good indication that something has gone wrong here. You can look at things like a large number of simultaneous connections from a single IP block that would be unlikely except in very specialized cases, or connections that are coming at you really, really fast. The number of algorithms here are kind of as broad as your imagination. A variant of this is generally called gray listing. It's kind of like challenge response in that you don't do this if you recognize where it's coming from. But when you see a new message come in, you temp fail the message. That is, you tell the sender that I can't take your message at this time. And if it's a good sender, it's not that big a deal. They put it back in their queue and in their next retry interview come along and try to deliver it to you again. And this time, you notice that you've seen them before and you accept the message. The reason this works is because spammers in general are using these spam engines that don't have queues. Because look at it from their perspective, the value of any one piece of email is very, very low to them. They make their money on huge bulk, not by making sure each one gets a good response rate. In fact, their response rate is crappy, although unfortunately not crappy enough. By the way, at the FTC spam forum in May of last year, a company that sells anti-spam technology pulled their customers, so these are people who have bought anti-spam technology, and found that I believe it was 38% of them had replied to a spam message at one time or another, and fully 16% of them had bought something that was advertised to them using spam. So if you have any doubts as to whether spam works, apparently it really does. I don't want to hear about any of you starting a new home-based business next week, though. This is really kind of a heuristic because there's obvious ways that spammers can get around it. So it's not clear that that's going to work in the long run. This is another we do this, they do that to counter. There was a very interesting paper earlier this week in this very conference called Email Prioritization, Reducing Delays on Legitimate Mail Caused by Junk Mail. It's got some claims that the traffic patterns are not what other people claim them to be, and they've got some real data, they've done analysis and whatnot. If they're right, then traffic-based filtering may be much less useful than we thought. I'm not completely convinced I believe it all yet, but it is nonetheless a very interesting paper that deserves more examination. The area we're kind of getting into now is identity-based filtering. This is essentially, if I know you, I'm going to let you through. Notice that that's almost exactly the same words I used to describe challenge response. So CR is actually also an identity-based solution. The problem is you really need authentication for this to work. I'm increasingly finding that spam seems to come from people that I personally know. Enough of it so that based on some back of the envelope calculations, it's unlikely that it's pure chance. Tom Christensen happens to send me a whole bunch of spam. A couple of the big names, I can't remember who they are right now, seem to send me a lot of spam. The exception to needing authentication is RBLs, because all you're operating on there is the IP address. And the IP address is really the one thing you have that is hard but not impossible to forge. Classic example of identity-based filtering is allow and block lists. You base that totally on the identity of who's sending you the mail. Another class is accreditation and reputation. These are being pushed heavily right now in business, although the motives of the people that are doing this are perhaps questionable. For example, there's one group called Project Lumos that's working on this. Well, Project Lumos turns out to be a project of the Email Service Providers Coalition, which is an offshoot of the Network Advertising Initiative. You might correctly figure out that these are legitimate email marketers who do not send spam, absolutely no, honest. And so they want a way to demonstrate to the world that they are good people, so we will, of course, happily accept all the mail that comes from legitimate email marketers. I know I'm going to. Allow lists and block lists are basic to almost every anti-spam technology. You'll see these come up over and over again. You just kind of have to have one these days. The main point of allow lists is you might actually get newsletters that your existing spam filters will classify as spam. And so what you want to do is whitelist that so it gets through. I actually do get some stuff that does have advertising in it, but I do still want to get it. The block lists are usable for blocking just annoying senders, deals with mail bombing, all kinds of things like that. Now, allow lists are nice because they're very cheap to implement on the receiving side. And so they can lower the cost to the recipient. The recipient, for example, if you're sending everything through a Bayesian filter that's fairly computationally intensive, the likelihood is that you're going to use up more and more CPU as the spam load goes up. But if you can allow list people that you know you want to correspond with, bypasses that algorithm entirely. So it's not just a way to get away from false positives, it's also a way to lower your own costs. There's two philosophies behind allow listing and block listing. To date, it's been essentially anything that's not explicitly illegal gets through, so you default to accept. Increasingly, we're seeing people talking about default to deny systems. So if you're not in my whitelist or present some other way that I'm willing to trust you, your mail gets blocked. So I said we need authentication. There's this whole area that's really been blowing up just this year called sender authentication. The problem, of course, is anyone can claim to be anyone they want to. And, oh, I should have said this earlier. The assumption that I'm getting things from people that I know leads me to believe that some of these worms going around are not just taking the address book to propagate, but also sending the address book back to some other site so that the spammers can build pairs. If, you know, I'm in somebody else's address book, there's a good chance that they're in my address book, and hence I might well trust them, and so they can send the mail from somebody that has at least already communicated with me. And so in the long run, what happens is, you know, the technology clearly exists. Whitelisting without authentication is going to collapse. But it is going to collapse. It's just a question of when. Authentication directly addresses fraud and phishing. Assume you all know what phishing is. Anyone who doesn't? Oh, good. I want to emphasize there's actually an editorial in the New York Times talking about these idiots who are doing authentication thinking it's going to solve spam. Well, I know a lot of these idiots, and none of us have, I think, at any time said that authentication is going to solve spam by itself. It can address fraud, because you have a better idea of who it actually comes from, but it only addresses spam by combining with one of these other algorithms. And I want to emphasize that very clearly because there's so much misunderstanding about this in the world. Now, we already have MTA to MTA authentication, such as SMTP auth and TLS. These are not heavily used, however, in large part because they involve some kind of previous arrangement. So you have to know who you're talking with in advance, have an out-of-band channel to share a secret or something like that. It's just not practical with day-to-day email. I don't know why I have that bullet point there, but I've said it already. There's pure per-user authentication out there, largely in the form of PGP and SMIME. Historically, those are not heavily used either, and historically, they've been difficult for users to deal with, largely because they require some sort of public key infrastructure, and those just have not really worked very well yet. Now, I know everyone's going to say, but what about the web of trust? Well, let's face it, easy for us, really, really hard for non-techies. I mean, it's just very clear. They don't understand it. It confuses and scares them. So, you know, something else is needed there. That doesn't mean, by the way, we can't use PGP, but we have to hide the details of the web of trust. However, the big observation is that you don't really need to authenticate the individual. You need to authenticate the sending domain. In some sense, this is really non-repudiability rather than authentication. It's a way to say, you know, I can prove that it came from you, and thereby assign responsibility back to people who can do something about it. So if you get spam from sendmail.com, you can contact our postmaster who has access to the logs, who will figure out who inside the company is spamming and hit them over the head with a baseball bat, if they're lucky. There's two major forms of authentication in play right now. The first is, and best known, is IP address-based authentication. Technically, this is not authentication at all, but it's been put in this class. The idea is you look at the list of the sender, or the domain of the sender, use DNS typically to go get some record that says, here's the list of addresses from which I'm allowed to, that I will send mail from. And if you've got a connection coming in from one of those addresses, then there's a good bet it is, in fact, coming from that domain. If it's coming from some other address, then you have reason to be suspicious that it's actually not. The problem is, this breaks easily. It fundamentally breaks the entire store and forward model of email that's been around since day one. No, day minus one, because the ARPANET was store and forward as well. And in fact, pretty much everything has been store and forward up until today. This breaks forwarding, aliasing, MX records, so forth. It's a non-trivial list of things. There are proposals to fix this, which vary from reasonably elegant to incredibly messy. All of the schemes that I know of right now involve storing the information that you need in a DNS text record. There's a lot of concerns about that. The DNS people hate the idea, absolutely hate it. They say you should have a new record type. Other people say, yeah, the last time we put in a new record type, it only took 5 years for it to propagate to the software out there. And the other thing is DNS, although it has been attacked some and has held up pretty well, this gives you yet another reason to attack DNS. Although, to be honest, if you attack DNS, you can't get to the A records, so you can't find the company you're attacking in the first place. So I'm not as concerned about this as some other people. In any case, it's not fundamental. DNS is not fundamental. The only fundamental thing is you go back to the purported domain and say, give me the information about you in such a way that it's you don't have to do some kind of third-party authentication. So like trees, X509 keys, for example, are tree structured. And here you don't need to do that because you're getting it directly from the person who's responsible. The best known identity-based solution by far is SPF. It was called sender permitted from up until fairly recently. Microsoft came out with caller ID, which I'll talk about in a second, and said one of the things about this is that it's a general policy framework of which this is only one piece. Meng Wanzhong promptly changed SPF to mean sender policy framework, although he didn't change the spec in anything, just the name of it. It validates the mail from address. There are pros and cons to this. Pro is that it's SPF is very low cost for the senders to implement. All they have to do is add an entry to their DNS. It's fairly low cost for the recipients. They have to do another DNS or, you know, another couple of DNS lookups. And it has a very compact policy language. The cons are that mail from is not an identity that users normally see. This does absolutely nothing to address the fraud and phishing problem. I say limited help for phishing. I think I just said it a little more strongly than that. I just don't see how it's going to help. And the solution to the forwarding problem called SRS is just about the ugliest solution I've ever seen, and I'm not at all certain it will even work because it produces very, very long addresses that very quickly exceed the maximum address size imposed by RFCs 2821 and 22. This up here is an example of an SPF policy record. They all start V equals SPF 1. This particular one says, I'll accept anything that where there's an A or an MX record for the purported domain that take the set of those addresses and then compare that to the incoming connection. And everything else I'm going to reject. There are a bunch of SPF records already published, you know, on the order of tens of thousands of them, which sounds like a lot, but on the internet really isn't. It's unclear how many recipients are actually checking them at this time. You go to the SPF website, and there's lots of stuff about how many people have published them, but I couldn't find a thing about how many people are actually reading them. Caller ID for email is the Microsoft proposal. Unlike SPF, validates the message header. In particular, it looks at resent sender, resent from, sender, and from in that order. It's also very low cost for the sender because, again, the sender just has to put in some DNS records. It's, again, fairly low cost for the recipients. It does address phishing head-on. It doesn't quite cover all of it. There's got to be limited MUA support, for example, to show that there's a resent sender or whatever. You probably want some indication in the MUA that there's something else going on here. And proposals are things like, you know, as simple as putting a red warning sticker next to messages that don't pass, or maybe a green, you know, thumbs up for ones that have passed. And it's relatively easy to solve the forwarding problem. All you have to do is stick in a resent sender or a resent from, and you're done. The main con of this for a lot of people is that the policy language is XML-based, and there's real concerns that this is too verbose to fit into a single DNS text record, and in particular that DNS may have to start falling back from UDP to TCP. If they do have to do that, then that substantially raises the cost of doing DNS lookups, and so this may turn out to be slightly unstable. The other major con, I say this kind of half as a joke, but very seriously, it's from Microsoft. And a lot of people, maybe even two or three people in this very audience, distrust Microsoft. So there's definite fear, uncertainty, and doubt. The good news is I have been working with them, and they understand this, and I believe they really are trying to do the right thing. So we'll see. I'm cautiously optimistic. Here's an example of a caller ID policy record. This is identical to the one you saw on the SPF side slide a moment ago. The main line is the one that's MA/A/MMMX/. Yeah. Whoops, I dropped something. There's supposed to be an MX, close MX in there. The point is that the empty A and MX, what do they call them, elements, say, look it up. You could also put values directly in there. Now, there is an ongoing, quite new actually, proposal called Sender ID, which is attempting to unify SPF and caller ID. This is coming out of the MERID working group of the IETF. MERID is Mail Authentication Records in DNS. It validates the message header, but it will fall back to the envelope if it wants. It does require an SMTP extension. The extension looks kind of like this. It's just putting submitter equals whatever the address is on the mail from line. The submitter must match the header. So you validate that, but then as you read the message, you make sure that that's not a lie. And so that, in fact, means if this is wrong and you want to reject the message right off, you don't have to read the whole message and message header and body in order to do the check. Some people feel that this is exceedingly important. I have to confess, I'm not quite as certain, but we'll see. The original proposal is it will use either SPF or caller ID syntax. I believe it said look for caller ID syntax, and then if it's not there, fall back to SPF. What we're seeing is an increasing push for using SPF syntax only. I really dislike the SPF syntax. It just seems really ugly to me. But on the other hand, I don't really like the XML syntax either, so I'm pretty neutral on this one. The pros of this is it does address phishing, unlike SPF. The cons are that it does require software updates at both ends. The others only need it at the recipient end, but because of this SMTP extension, you're going to have to update the software of the sender. But you know, to me, that's okay, because after all, we're trying to raise costs. And I better hurry up, because I'm getting late here. Issues are not clear what policy language is going to be used. And if you find yourself having to do both the caller ID hack around the forwarding problem and SRS at the same time, then this is the worst of all possible worlds. The other big class is cryptographic. You sign messages using a per domain key, distribute public cert via DNS, kind of same as before. It doesn't have any aliasing or forwarding problems, but it does have problems if the message gets modified in transit. We don't know how often that happens as yet. And so it's a real interesting question whether this is going to work. The two proposals are Yahoo domain keys, which has been around for a while now, and VeriSign. This is not yet released. I don't even know if I'm supposed to be saying this, but they're starting to float a proposal that's a variant on S/MIME. And S/MIME actually will solve the munging problem. The accreditation is, once you've got some kind of identity, you can start to accredit. Accreditation is basically third-party vouches for you, generally using something like bonding. So the sender puts up a bond, and the accreditor will take it away from them if they violate the terms under which they got the bond, like spamming. It's forward-looking. It says, you know, the sender says, I promise to do this, Scout's honor, in the future. Its sender pays. You could imagine a recipient pays version, but that would be pretty stupid. And you can have a very rich information set. It can include things like, well, what is this company's policy? You know, what are their lists? Are they opt-in or opt-out or double opt-in or what have you? So there are some interesting things here. Reputation is kind of the opposite. It's backward-looking. You look at what a site has actually done and assume that it's going to continue to do that in the future, and it's constantly being updated, so if they do change their behavior, you can tell. It is a collaborative service in general. It doesn't absolutely have to be, but generally it is, with all the pluses and minuses that results in. Problem, it's easy to acquire negative information. People are happy to report that somebody's spamming, but when was the last time you thought you'd go to a central agency and say, I just thought you ought to know that my friend over there doesn't send me spam? So the positive information that you really need for reputation to work is all done by assumption. That's, we haven't gotten many complaints, so probably that's a good person or a good sender. It can be sender pays or recipient pays. I'm a strong believer that it needs to be sender pays because we've already raised the cost to recipients far, far too high. If you want to see a rant about that, I think I may have it. There's a ACMQ magazine in the December-January issue most recently. I have an article, editorial, whatever, which is intentionally a rant that talks about this, so you might want to look at that. RBLs, by the way, are reputation services. They're just negative-only reputation. There's no positives in there. Economic schemes. I'm gotten old enough that I'm no longer an anarchist or something, because I'm inclined to believe that economic solutions are the ultimate solution. The problem that creates spam is simply because it costs the sender effectively zero to send. And so in that scenario, their best strategy for maximizing profit is to send as much as possible. If you actually have to pay for things on a per unit basis, you try and keep it closely targeted. So, you know, a physical mailing, even like a postcard, costs, you know, something between, you know, 30 and 50 cents each for a company to send out. And so you have a high incentive to make sure you're only sending it to people who might be interested in your product. Economics does not have to be cash-based. That's a big mistake. People, you know, say, I believe in economics. They immediately go, I don't want to have to pay 5 cents for each message I sent. Might not have to. E-postage is the cash-based version of it. It might be credit-oriented. The question is, of course, who gets the money? And possibilities are that the recipient gets the money. ISP for the recipient gets the money, or my personal favorite, a third party gets the money who does nothing. Their role in life is to collect the money. Cool job. I have actually seen this proposed, however. There's an interesting proposal out there which is pretty much still in the research phase called Shred that you might want to look at. This is a credit-based solution, so there's cash underneath it, but you don't have to shell out the cash up front. Bonding is essentially accreditation. You post a bond saying, I promise not to spam, and if you do, you lose it. Habeas is the best known example of this. The problem with accreditation, or with bonding in particular, is the people who bond tend to be people who are sending a lot of mail, that is to say, legitimate email marketeers. And so there's something that's been referred to as the habeas effect. When habeas came out, they've got their copyrighted haiku. People started saying, oh, if it's got that haiku in it, it's probably an ad. I will throw it away. Did exactly the opposite of what it was intended to do. If you start getting mail that is not ads, that has the habeas thing, haiku in it, then you'll be, that will change. Hash cash is kind of similar, except you pay with CPU cycles or memory or disk bandwidth or, you know, many, many algorithms. Hash cash, the algorithms are designed to be difficult to compute, so it takes some substantial amount of resources on the sender's machine, but easy to verify so that recipient can very quickly make sure that it is the correct answer. The Penny Black project from Microsoft Research discusses that, and by the way, some of the other schemes. These are often combined with challenge response, sort of like challenge response, in that you only pay if the recipient asks you to. So I might, for example, not charge my mother to send me email. Big problems with these are, you know, free mailing lists, for example. People say, I run this mailing list, I can't afford to pay, you know, 5 cents for each message. But, you know, that can be solved through whitelisting, basically. What about purchase acknowledgments? I go and purchase a product, and people have to attach cash to give me my receipt. That's probably going to mean they will minimize what they send me, and that will reduce my information. So that's not necessarily a good thing. This, by the way, is also a problem with whitelisting, because in general you don't know what address that's going to come from. So default to deny systems may be problematic there. Of course, there are zombies. Have to mention zombies. These are machines controlled by an evil entity without the permission of the owners. I put that in when I realized the owner might be the evil entity. These are strongly associated with home machines on always-up connections such as cable modems and DSL. People increasingly just leave their computers on, so forth. I have seen an unsubstantiated claim that there are more than one zombie clusters of greater than 100,000 machines I have seen the heard the claim that the largest supercomputer in the world by quite a bit are these zombies. So, you know, the network of workstations kind of thing. Huge, huge amounts of compute power there, which, of course, breaks many algorithms. Who cares about computational puzzles if you've got 100,000 machines that, by the way, you didn't pay for to go and compute all of these puzzles? Cool. Even crypto-based ones, if the key is, for example, stored on the disk, the zombied machine, they can just use that. So there was a report I heard just yesterday. I have not had a chance to substantiate it yet. Quick web search didn't show it up. But apparently, quite recently, and it was either day before yesterday or some slowly over the last few weeks, Comcast finally started to block port 25 outgoing. Apparently not for everyone, just the customers that they found were not good players. And the claim, the really interesting one, is that the total amount of spam on the internet, on the whole internet, immediately dropped by 35%. Yeah, I think it sounds exaggerated too, but that's why I say I haven't had a chance to substantiate it yet. So I'm actually finishing up here. Predictions. I'm supposed to be a visionary or whatever, although you can see I need glasses. Spam's never going to go away. Spam is going to be like cockroaches. You cannot eliminate it entirely, but you can keep it under control. And if we think about the perfect solution, I'm afraid that we will never get there and we will bypass things that would actually have helped. Authentication is going to help, but as I said earlier, it's not going to solve the problem by itself. But I do think spam is going to get to the stage where it's manageable, if you will, in 2 to 3 years. Some people are predicting sooner than that. I hope they're right. I tend to estimate out longer. The only problem is it's like doing software estimates. They want me to say I can do it in 6 weeks, and I tell them 12, and they say do it in 6, and it always takes 12. So that's the way I am. In fact, usually if they say 6, it takes, you know, 15 weeks to do it. Legislation, I haven't mentioned, but it will scare away bit players. Spammers are already, some have said, I wouldn't get into this business anymore. It's just too risky. It's gotten too expensive. I think this is good. But it's not going to scare away the large commercial spammers. They can always, for example, just move offshore, and you know they may prefer to live in Florida or some other place like that, but you know, for $250,000 a year, I guess I could live in Bermuda if I absolutely had to. But authentication is going to help the enforcement of legislation, which is in fact the biggest part. There's been laws against fraud forever, but finding them is harder, and people simply stop accepting unauthenticated mail, which is not going to happen immediately, of course, but I think may happen in the future, then you can dig them out. So that's it, and I'm happy to take some questions. I'm sorry I ran a little longer than I expected to. So there's mics in the two outer aisles. Perry?
Just to comment on the 35% drop thing. I haven't actually seen that, and I have no idea if anyone's actually, if Comcast or anyone else is actually claiming that. But I usually get somewhere in the order of 30,000 attempts to spam me a day, and in the last few days, I've noticed no actual change in that. My 24-hour count last night was a little over 34,000. So I haven't noticed anything. So if I don't know where anyone would get that statistic from.
Drat.
I can follow up on that. ZDNet, as of Tuesday, is claiming that there is the 35% drop, and you can catch media online. I just did a Google search, news.google.com search for it, so there's the coverage you were looking for. Okay.
Yes.
I'm sorry about your mailbox.
I just report what I've heard. I'm not going to get into that fight. Yes.
So I'm curious. It would seem to me that these schemes where the sender cost is low and the receiver cost is fairly low, I would just think those would be non-starters, because it seems like you want to, I mean, I mean, I just don't understand why anyone would say more than that and then say, okay, let's move on to the next scheme.
Well, if the low-cost solutions actually do something to, for example, provide identity...
It's the disparity between the sender cost and the receiver cost that I'm worried about. That if it's, right. if it's more expensive for the receiver, then I would think that would be a non-starter.
Let us suppose that the sender cost is zero and the receiver cost is low, but it also stops spam because you can now track back to people and hit them over the head with a baseball bat. That's good enough for me. In fact, that's, you know, something which is low cost on both ends is the best of all possible worlds. What you're arguing is that the only way to solve spam is economics, and that may be true, but I think economics is a good approach. You know, we have to do cost shifting and whatnot, but I don't think it's the only solution.
Yeah, I don't know that it's the only solution, but I guess the problem I have is in one of those 17 slides about how really, really, really bad it is that you flashed through right at the beginning, that the reason it's bad is because it's a denial of service attack. And so if sender cost is free and receiver cost is not free, you're basically, you know, opening up a denial of service attack. And I guess that's the reason that I worry about it. You're probably right that I think that ultimately what I'm saying is that economics is the right way to solve it. But okay. That's what bothers me.
Yes.
Hi. Robinson actually has argued in the past that his algorithms are robust against problems with statistical independence.
I'm sorry, the way the speakers are set up, I'm only getting the echo off the back wall. Can you just say that again?
Gary Robinson in the past has argued that his algorithms are robust against problems with statistical independence, and actually the effective size factor algorithms are actually taking advantage of statistical independence assumptions to handle token redundancy problems.
You're talking specifically about Bayesian filtering?
Yes.
Yeah. As I said, the naive assumption is extremely high or problematic, let's say, and I do believe they can be exploited for that reason. So, it's one of the reasons I don't think that Bayesian filtering is, in fact, the end of spam. As much as I'd love to say it is. Yes?
Yeah, I did do an informal survey of the domains where I was receiving spam, in other words, where the relay engines were. And I did this twice, once for login, and then again, just somebody, Ashley, said, what were my heuristics? All the heuristics was to look at the receive byline, the last relayer, before I got the email. And over 20% of all the last relay sites were Comcast. So if Comcast started blocking outgoing port 24, except from people who were supposed to be sending email, that would knock out a fifth of all spam, at least in what I receive.
Yeah. Well, again, I don't have substantiation for any of that, so I'm not going to be able to answer definitively. Obviously, we'll need to get some more data on that and see what's going on. It seems like it ought to knock out some. Comcast even says we are the biggest spammer in the world.
Sure.
So, it's got to do something. The question is whether it will be enough to make any difference at all. My guess is if it does make a difference, it'll only be for a short period.
Right. People will move to other places that aren't being blocked. But then again, there's a place for legislation. You have legislation that says if you're not allowed to, if you're not supposed to have a mail server, you can't send an email. So it's sort of like RFC. Come on, there is an RFC out there. It says you're not supposed to spoof your source address. Now, it's never been enforced, but certainly universities do this. Any firewall will do this. This is, I think, an extension. It's 2267.
Okay.
I'd like to cast a different light on the issue of sender cost versus receiver cost.
Sure.
When you talk about that in that context, the senders you're talking about are the people we do want to hear mail from. They're the ones that are authenticating themselves. So I think they're the same community, and I think it's pointless to argue about whether I pay a little more when I get mail from you that I want, or you pay a little bit more to send it to me. The point is that, as you say, neither of us is paying very much, and we hope that the result is that neither of us has to put up with all the junk.
Yeah, that's actually a very good point. For the legitimate senders, we assume we're kind of a closed set, then shifting costs from the recipient to the sender actually shifts costs from me to me, and so it's a net wash, whereas that's not going to be true for the spammers. So, good, very good point.
One of the most recent things that I'm seeing is, in terms of unwanted mail, I don't know if I call it spam, is the rejection notice that you get. You sent a spam message that had a virus in it. A little bit difficult when I use Linux and I don't use Windows, so it's hard for me to have a Windows virus. And so almost all the spam has forged from headers, and then you get return responses from systems. Do you recommend then that mail administrators just turn that off, or how can you address that issue?
There's, you know, when I first started writing email software, it was very unreliable, would be a polite way to put it. Excuse that the email system ate my homework was a perfectly legitimate one and was often, in fact, true. And I really wanted to turn email into a reliable medium, which it pretty much has been. But the problem is reliable means you either deliver the message or you get a bounce back to the sender saying it could not be delivered. I don't personally have time to look at the bounces anymore. There's just way too many of them. So if you think this through, what we've done is turn it back into an unreliable medium. And that's a bad thing. SPF does, in fact, directly address the mail from line, which is the bounce address. So, you know, that's the one area where SPF really does shine. I actually have some other ideas on how to make it more effective, but I don't want to talk about them yet because I haven't thought them through yet. They may just be totally brain dead and I haven't figured it out. So I prefer not to humiliate myself in public more than absolutely necessary.
Just to follow up on Rick Farrow's comment, there's a lot of sophisticated distributed control being used on them now. You'll get multiple spamming attempts from different zombies to try to get past blocks. My suspicion is that if you turn off, you know, an entire network like Comcast for the spammers, all that ends up happening is that they use their zombies on other networks to get the spam through to you anyway.
Right.
So, you know, it's certainly useful, but I doubt that simply turning them off would manage to actually reduce the spam because they'll use their other machines to get it through.
Yeah, absolutely. Certainly, if, you know, like a dike, you plug one hole, if there's 30 other holes, you're not going to hold back the sea very long. Any other questions? Oh, one more.
As someone who runs an ISP, how can I get more complaints about spam that's sent through my ISP? Currently, my guess is that only about 1 in 500,000 spam generates a complaint, and that's not enough for me to shut something down.
The main issue is getting information from more places. So yeah, you probably only get a small amount coming back to you, but places like Spam House, for example, collect these things, and they have a rather larger network, as does, you know, Vipple's Razor, for example, and that sort of things. But yes, these things where you're actually looking at effectively reputation are heavily skewed toward the bigger players simply because they have more information to gather or have more information available to them to analyze. The AOL apparently has a staff of, what did Carl say, like 10 people who do nothing except read complaints all day long. Boy, now that's a job for you, isn't it? and you're not AOL, unless you've grown a lot since the last time I talked to you. All right.
Thank you.